If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Over the past year, the race to develop effective vaccines for COVID-19 has thrown a spotlight on historical efforts to combat lethal diseases. Yet for all of that, the exploits of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who pioneered smallpox inoculations in 18th century England, remains little known. A new book by Jo Willett highlights the life of this pioneering scientist, feminist, and woman of letters. Here, in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, Jo tells the extraordinary story of a woman who changed the course of medical history.
Your new book tells a remarkable story of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. Now, there were so many facets to this woman, aren't there? She was a fiercely independent poet, a woman of letters, and a feminist. But I guess we've got to start with the extraordinary role she played in the battle to defeat smallpox. The work she did on developing an inoculation for smallpox predated Edward Jenner by the best part of a century. But to my shame, I barely heard of her, and I'd hazard a guess that I'm far from alone in that. So my first question is, why do you think Montagu is so little known? Why has she lived so comprehensively in the shadow of Edward Jenner?
Yes, interesting question, Spencer, really. Well, she was an aristocratic woman, living at a time when that was perhaps not the easiest thing to be. The book is coming out now because April is the 300th anniversary of her decision to inoculate her daughter.
Sure.
And it's that which is the really key thing, because she'd been in Constantinople before and she had inoculated her son there, but other people were interested in inoculation at the time. So actually the previous ambassador had his two sons inoculated there. So it was kind of in the air. And I think that's perhaps part of the problem, that it was around. The Royal Society had talked about it. She, of course, as a woman, wasn't able to be a member of the Royal Society, but she thought this was an interesting thing. And because she was an aristocratic woman, she actually tried to play down her own involvement in it, which I think didn't help it.
So I wonder if we could kind of go back to the beginning and explain how she came into contact with smallpox and when she realised that inoculation could provide an effective means of combating it. Because am I right from reading your book that this was kind of personal to her, wasn't it?
Very much so, very much so. I mean, smallpox, when her grandparents were alive, smallpox was not that serious a thing. It was the kind of thing that you wanted your children to get, a bit like people used to with measles, to kind of get it out of the way. But by the time she was an adult, it was had got more and more serious. And she had a beloved only brother who at 19 died of smallpox. And that was a terrible thing. And then the following year, she got it herself. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily survive. Only one in three people died.
Right.
So it was a huge thing, her getting it. She got it very seriously. The people in the press said she was going to die. The outside the street, they put straw down to quieten the horses. She did survive, but of course she survived pockmarked like people did.
Right.
So she totally lost her looks. She lost her eyebrows. And after that, she always had what people used to call the Wortley stare, kind of quite a sort of scary stare.
Right.
And she, also her eyesight suffered as a result. She could never cope with bright light again. That was a very common thing. And she had been at court. So being beautiful was a pretty important thing. She had this line, beauties and monarchs rule with equal sway. And she'd lost her looks. I mean, she'd survived, but she'd lost her looks. So she knew how serious it was.
So am I right in saying, did she first get the idea for inoculating people when she was in Turkey? Is that right?
That's right. Her husband went off to, he was made the ambassador to Turkey. So normally men would go by themselves. It was always men who became ambassadors. But she was, being Lady Mary, she was determined to go with him. She travelled across Europe with him and their son, who was only three at the time. And when she was there, she was aware that inoculation took place. She was the first woman to go and dine alone with Turkish women and, you know, wives of the vizier and that kind of thing. And they told her about it. And so, of course, she got interested there.
And how does she, so what does she do then? How does she go about, because I guess a lot of people would have just left it at that. But she was obviously the kind of person who thought, right, I can make this work for me and people I know. How does she go about doing that?
Do you mean in Turkey or do you mean when she came back to England?
Well, both in Turkey and in England.
So in Turkey, she made sure that Wortley, her husband, was out of the way.
Yeah.
And then she asked a little old Greek woman to come, because this was what used to happen. The Turks used to get Greeks or Armenians to do the inoculation. And that person would risk their own life if they hadn't had smallpox already by going to somebody who had smallpox and taking a little bit of smallpox pus, pox pus.
Yeah.
And then bringing it back in a walnut shell, they would then make cuts on people's wrists and ankles, and then they would put a little bit of the pus in there. So basically, it went into your bloodstream. They'd strap the walnut shell on, so they make sure everything stayed in, and then they'd wait 10 days. And after about 10 days, people would begin to show very, very mild forms of smallpox.
Sure.
But I mean, you know, hardly anything compared to what Lady Mary had been through. And 3 or 4 days later, they'd be better and then they'd be protected for the rest of their lives.
And so she came back to England subsequently.
She came back to England. So she had her son done there.
Yeah.
And she'd taken out with her a surgeon called Dr. Maitland. Now, we think of surgeons as very prestigious, but in those days, a physician was the prestigious one and a surgeon was, you know, closer to a butcher in a sense.
Right, okay.
But he had heard about inoculation. He was interested. So he went with her and helped her in Turkey. She came back in 1718. In 1719, there was another outbreak, but she was too nervous to do anything about it because she knew it would be very incendiary to do anything. But in 1721, there was a really bad outbreak. She had a friend and neighbour called James Craggs who died. She had a young cousin called Hester Fielding who died. And she thought, this is ridiculous. I need to protect my only daughter. So she wrote to Maitland and he came from Hertfordshire, which was his practice, to Twickenham, where she was living. He was quite reluctant, but she was very keen. And together they inoculated her little girl. And so her little girl was the first person to be inoculated in the West.
So this is obviously a landmark moment in the fight against smallpox. Why was he so reluctant? What worried him about doing this?
Well, he knew that it was controversial. Doctors didn't like it because they felt that it was undermining them. And this little simple folk practice was going to be a problem for them. And they probably wouldn't get many fees as a result. People Sure. wouldn't call them when they got smallpox. So even in Turkey, she wrote to her great friend Sarah Chiswell saying that if I come back to England, I may have the courage to war with them, because she knew that doctors wouldn't be happy. Clerics didn't like it because they felt it was interfering with nature
Right.
and shouldn't happen. And politically, it was also very controversial. Ultimately, the Whigs tended to like it and the Tories tended to not like it.
Why is that? Why was there that distinction?
Well, partly because, Lady Mary did the inoculation and Maitland had wanted to have physicians there to observe it. She didn't want that. She said, yeah. Okay, 3 days after, we'll let some doctors in to look. And she also asked some ladies and persons of distinction to come in. We don't know who those people were. But somehow word reached Princess Caroline, who was married to Prince of Wales, who then became George II in time. She was German and was living here. She was brighter than George II. And she could see this was a good thing. So she then started manoeuvring to see if it could, if you know, smallpox could be, inoculation could be something they could do. She herself had a daughter who had suffered it very badly the previous year, and she didn't want her two younger daughters to get it.
Yeah.
And George II and Princess Caroline, the Whigs liked them, and they liked the Whigs. The Tories thought they were German, they didn't like them, so it became political because of that.
Yeah, sure. And so, how much did the fact that she was a woman prejudice the establishment's reception of her discovery?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Yes. For instance, Sir Hans Sloane, who was the royal surgeon at the royal physician at the time, he wrote about inoculation, but he said the ambassador and his lady wife brought it back. He absolutely, totally played Mary down. And it was only sort of 30 years later that he rewrote to accept that actually it had really been her. Wortley had virtually nothing to do with it. Yes. So, yeah, absolutely. Being a woman was a major problem for her in that sense.
And before inoculation, I mean, what did the medical establishment do to combat smallpox? I mean, what were the treatments?
There was virtually nothing you could do.
Right.
There was some dispute about whether you either kept people very hot or you kept people very cold. And neither made any difference at all. But of course they took their fees for doing it. And she had already been aware of that. When she had smallpox herself, she was treated by someone called Dr. Samuel Garth, and she'd written a poem being rather critical of him.
Right, OK.
Yeah.
And how did all this opposition that she faced, how did that affect her on a personal level? I mean, was she the sort of person to embrace confrontation and sort of say, well, I'm going to prove you all wrong? I mean, where did that inner steel come from?
She was a controversial person, definitely.
Right.
And she liked controversy. In her whole life, you can see that, you know, she's quite Marmite. She had, you know, big passions with people. She fell out with people. She very much knew her own mind. But having said that, she said that every day of her life, she regretted having done what she did because it was so controversial. After the inoculation, when young Mary, her daughter, was a little girl, they spent their time going around in the carriage off to aristocratic households because they were invited to inoculate. And young Mary then wrote about how she remembered the significant shrugs of servants and the way people kind of booed the carriage as it went by. It was very difficult.
But did she feel vindicated by the end of her life, or was it a case of it was a battle not worth fighting?
Well, sadly, I don't think she ever really got the praise for it.
Yeah.
She lived abroad for the last 25 years of her life and only then returned to London right at the end. People by then were praising her. But she was sort of quite famous just for being her, not necessarily for inoculation, because she also was a writer and she was quite a character. And by the time she returned to London, her son-in-law was the Prime Minister. So, she moved in great circles anyway, really.
Sure. Now, how significant do you think her work in the eventual victory over smallpox was? I mean, is it fair to say that no Lady Mary, no Edward Jenner, or is that kind of overstating it?
I don't think it is really overstating, Spencer, because what happened was the medical establishment accepted it, but they were still determined to medicalize. So they insisted on bleeding and purging and putting people on restricted diets before they were inoculated. And sometimes when people died, which they did, it probably was because of the bleeding and purging. But of course, no one could prove that. And so Edward Jenner, as a child, went through that whole process of having to be bled and purged. And he had a really terrible experience. And it was because of that that he thought, I really think I need to do something about this. There must be a different way of doing it. And he made the mental leap to realise that dairymaids didn't get smallpox, and worked out that was because they were getting cowpox. So he right. then introduced cowpox into people rather than smallpox, in effect.
Sure.
So that's a simplified way of explaining it, but that's right. what happened, really. Yeah, so I think you can say without Lady Mary, if he hadn't been inoculated, he wouldn't have made that leap.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Into her life came Francesco Algarotti, who was Italian. He was the same age as her son. So she was in her 40s, he was in his 20s. She was completely dazzled by him.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Now, as you just alluded to, Lady Mary's work on vaccination, it was world-changing, but ironically, it wasn't the thing for which she was most famous at the time. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about her collaboration with the poet Alexander Pope, because that was something else that also put her in the public eye, wasn't it?
Yes, of course. Yes. So as a young woman, a young married woman, she came to London and she kind of fell in with a group of sort of the writers and thinkers of the day. So people Congreve and John Gay, and she became best friends with Alexander Pope at that time. And they collaborated on writing poems. I mean, as an aristocrat, she didn't need to, and in fact, it wouldn't be a good idea to be published. But she collaborated with Pope and Gay on a series of poems that unfortunately then were published.
Right.
And so that wasn't great for her reputation at all. And one of them actually was about smallpox. Was so normally it was a series of seven poems that kind of, and each one was to do with the day of the week. And the final one was traditionally, because they'd taken the idea from Latin poems, was about death. But she wrote one about smallpox, which shows again how important smallpox was. But anyway, so they were great friends. Pope was very different from her. He was middle class. She was aristocratic. He was Tory. She was Whig. But they were similar. He was very small. He had a disease when he was young, and so which had restricted his growth, and he was always in pain. And I think they were both outsiders in that sense, and they both used wit and irony to kind of deal with the things they coped with. So I think that's probably why there was a bond. So she went off to Turkey. He gave her a red leather-bound copy of their poems when she left. And while she was away in Turkey, he wrote her increasingly kind of amorous letters. He obviously had a huge crush on her, and he sent her poems which were clearly relating to her. As she returned, she got closer to England, it was obviously going to be a little bit difficult. And he had written a love poem about two young lovers who had done a double suicide at Stanton Harcourt. He wrote it to her, obviously kind of implying, and she, again, characteristically, wrote a sort of witty, jokey poem back about, oh, well, never mind, they've died because Mr. Pope has written them a poem. You know, and he got the message and realized that she was basically saying, actually, I'm not really that keen on you. So they kind of continued back in London. They were part of the same circle of friends. He had a house in Twickenham, his famous house in Twickenham, where he had this garden and grotto. And she and Wortley rented a house in Twickenham nearby. And again, they became friends. He commissioned a portrait of her, which hung in his best room forever. But something meant that they fell out. And we don't really know exactly why. Her family said it was because he did say to her, I'm in love with you. And she just laughed at him. But there are other theories as to why it happened. But then they fell out very, very badly. And he started writing about her. And of course, he was much more established than her as a writer and could write publicly about her. And she teamed up with another friend of theirs called John Harvey and wrote a response to one of Pope's poems. And that just made the whole thing worse. And it got completely out of hand. And Pope won, really. Pope won.
And what did that do to her reputation?
Well, I think it certainly meant she lost a lot of friends.
Yeah.
And also that she got a reputation for being a harridan, for being, you know, he satirised her other place. He used to call her Sappho, although Sapphic didn't have quite the connotation it has with us now. But he was saying that Wortley was very mean, that she was horrible to people. One bit he said that Wortley and Mary had been glad that their son had been drowned at sea. In fact, their son had been lost at sea. But, I mean, even if he had been drowned, there's no way Mary would have been glad that he'd been drowned at sea. Yes, yes. So, no, he vilified her totally. It reminds me a bit of sort of Mary Beard stuff recently, when Mary Beard's been vilified.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
And it's that thing about a middle-aged woman. And even now, it's harder to protect yourself.
Sure. So your book is called The Pioneering Life of Mary Wortley Montagu, Scientist and Feminist. Now, we've covered off the scientist side. Turn into the feminism. I mean, how did her feminism inform her writings? And what did her particular brand of feminism look like?
Yes, interesting. Well, as a teenager, she spent her whole time in her father's library. They lived in Thoresby in Nottinghamshire, and probably no one really ever been in this library, but there were masses of books there. And she read all the female writers there, including one by a feminist who predated her called Mary Estelle, who was a bit older than her.
Yeah.
And Mary Stell had written a book saying that really women should be educated separately from men. And Mary loved this idea. And she loved the idea of being an abbess, which is what Mary Stell had suggested. So right from the beginning, she was interested in what being a woman meant. I mean, remember, the word feminism had not been used and wouldn't be used for another 150 years.
Sure.
But she still was always interested in women. Because she was aristocratic, you had to have an arranged marriage. That was the standard thing. It was sorted. And she met Wortley, Edward Wortley Montagu, and it looked like they might get married, but her father wasn't happy with the terms of the marriage or proposed marriage. So he was about to force her into an arranged marriage with a man with a wonderful name of Clotworthy Skeffington.
That is a wonderful name.
And so Wortley suggested to her that they elope, and so they eloped. So, and that, weirdly, that's a feminist act for her because she got out of that forced marriage. I mean, sure. You don't think of eloping as feminist, but it was. And she knew already that she wasn't in love with Wortley, which again, I don't know, can you say that's feminist? But, you know, it meant that she was very interested in this whole area. And then they went off to Constantinople. When they came back, she became great friends with Mary Stell. And they used to often talk about things and write responses to experiences that were going, things that were happening in life. So, for instance, there was a young woman called Eleanor Bowes who had died very young, people thought at the hands of her husband. And so Mary Stell and Mary Wortley Montagu sat down together one afternoon. They both wrote a poem about this. So there was a lot of that where they were thinking about women.
And what did the establishment make of her writings? I mean, how were they received?
You have to think that they weren't published. They were passed around for people to enjoy reading them. Sometimes, as I said, sometimes things were published, which wasn't ideal. Mm. I think she was respected as a writer, but there's no way she could have the clout that someone like Alexander Pope could have. It was just almost like a game. She did try to write some journalism for which she got paid. But again, that was anonymous. You know, she often wrote anonymously if she was going to be in the public gaze. But I think now it's very interesting to look back on her poems. And she is a very good poet. And another wonderful bit of her writing is her letters. Her letters are fantastic. And really, I think she'd be much better known. She's so lively. She's so interesting. She writes about so many things. They're just a great bit of work.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the letters? I mean, were they written? I know she wrote quite a lot in Turkey, didn't she? And that had quite an impact on how people back in England perceived Turkey. I mean, I wonder if you just go into a bit more detail on that, please.
Of course. So she wrote letters all her life. But when she came back from Constantinople, Mary Stell said to her, you should think about putting together, compiling the letters of your experience in Turkey, which we now know as the embassy letters.
Sure.
So she had kept all the letters that she'd received, and then she'd made copies of the ones that she'd written, but she edited it quite a lot. So actually, it's not really what she wrote. It's kind of what she wrote in retrospect of her whole experience. The story with those embassy letters was the idea was they would be published after she died so as not to cause any problems for her. Classic Lady Mary, really, towards the end of her life, gave them to a cleric in Rotterdam and said, please make sure these letters are published. She didn't know him, but he was the only person she thought she would give them to. He thought, oh, this is a bit incendiary, a little bit difficult. So he showed them to her daughter and son-in-law, who absolutely weren't at all keen to have those letters published. So they paid him off. But what he hadn't realised that when he was in Rotterdam, some English travellers had borrowed them overnight, copied them, and they then sold those letters on. And so they were published after her life, and everybody loved them. There was a whole craze about Turkey as a result. And that's really when she became much more famous. So after her death.
Right.
But then apart from the embassy letters, there are all her other letters that she wrote through her life. There are some wonderful letters when she and Workley were courting. And then there's a whole series of letters when she lived abroad for sort of 25 years of her life in middle age, back to England, missing everybody and what happened to her then.
Now, as you mentioned, she married Edward Montagu. But that, am I right in saying that that relationship turned stale and then she then eloped with someone else when she was in middle age? Is that right?
She didn't really elope with him.
Right.
What happened? Yes, she probably shouldn't really have married Workley, but she did. And they rubbed along. They were just very different from each other, but they rubbed along. But in middle age, I think she had really a midlife crisis. She'd lost a lot of friends. Things weren't going very well with her daughter. Her only son was very difficult. And into her life came Francesco Algarotti, who was Italian. He was the same age as her son. So she was in her 40s. He was in his 20s. She was completely dazzled by him. He was intellectually fascinating. She loved Italian anyway. They could converse. He was very courteous to her. He wrote about how wonderful she'd been about smallpox. And she fell completely for him. He was very sexualized. Unbeknown to her, he was bisexual. And he started having an affair with her friend, John Harvey, who she'd written the poem to about Pope. I can only surmise, but I think that Algarotti just basically went to bed with everybody he met.
Right.
And so he just seduced her, and she was just overpowered by her feelings towards him. And her poems, her poems are so full of irony and sarcasm, and her poems there are just totally full of emotion for him. But he, was not only having an affair with Harvey, he was having an affair with about six other people at the same time. And so he then went off to St. Petersburg, to the court there. And she then came up with this idea that maybe they could live together in Venice.
Right.
And so she set off to Venice to do that. And assuming that he would follow her, he started having an affair with Frederick the Great and really wasn't so keen to meet up with Lady Mary. Right.
He sounds like quite the character.
He really was. Yeah. He really was. Yeah. It's hard to find him very likable because he hurt her so much, really.
Sure.
But then also she seems so vulnerable. You think, what are you doing? You're fooling yourself. She pretended to Workley and all her friends that she was travelling abroad because of her health. But in fact, she was heading towards Venice. He never actually made it to Venice, but they did finally meet up together and spent a couple of months together when it became evident that really that was the end of the relationship.
Sure.
And then she stayed on. She stayed on in Europe.
Did you warm to her in the process of writing your book? I mean, what kind of woman did you discover in your research?
I really love her, Spencer. I think she's fantastic. She's such a character. She's so vibrant. She seems to be so much for me, a woman for now. I mean, I think she should be as well known as Virginia Woolf or Mary Shelley. And you're right, we don't really know about her. I didn't know about her until I started reading her, looking into her. So I do warm to her. I mean, she was a terrible snob, which is difficult. As I say, she rubbed people up the wrong way. She often got things very wrong, just plain wrong. But she's always fun. She's always fun.
That was Jo Willett. Her new book, The Pioneering Life of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, Scientist and Feminist, was published by Pen and Sword History in March. You can find a link in the episode description of this podcast. Jo is also writing a feature on Lady Mary, which you can read in an upcoming issue of BBC History magazine soon. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for the latest episode in our Bayeux Tapestry series.